And so here, it begins a big explanation about morality or ethical conduct for a monastic. And so this is kind of the beginning practice, you know, when we have the three higher trainings, you know, sila, samadhi, panya, or ethical conduct, you know, concentration and wisdom. And so here is where it's beginning all with ethical conduct, because by keeping ethical conduct, you're able to calm your verbal and physical actions, and thus calm your mind. You're also able to free yourself of a lot of remorse and regret, and so you're able to concentrate better. Yeah, you create less negative karma, so it's easier to have a good rebirth to continue your dharma practice. You create less karma, negative karma, and more positive karma, so you have fewer obscurations to gaining realizations, and your mind is nourished by this positive potential, which enables you to gain realizations. And so here, he starts describing what that means. Okay, so he says, how is a monk perfected in ethical conduct? And here's the Buddha asks that question and then responds to it. And he says, abandoning the taking of life, he dwells refraining from taking life, without stick or sword, scrupulous, compassionate, trembling for the welfare of all beings. Okay? So it's nice, you know, not taking life, no need for any kind of weapon. Yeah? Scrupulous, compassionate, and caring so much for the welfare of sentient beings that one trembles. Okay? This, don't take it literally. It doesn't mean you go around with Parkinson's, okay? It's, you know, it's meaning in your heart. You're so sensitive that that's going on. Okay, so there we have the first precept. Then he says, abandoning the taking of what is not given, he dwells refraining from taking what is not given, living purely, accepting what is given, awaiting what is given, without stealing. Okay? So only using things that are given, only possessing things that are freely given. And so accepting what is given when somebody gives it without dropping hints and so on. And so really putting oneself in that situation where you really are seeing your life as you are sustained by other people's gifts. You don't go out and steal and get things for yourself. So that's the second precept. Then abandoning sexual behavior, he lives far from it, aloof from the village practice of sex. So completely outside of the household or life. Yeah. You can imagine the city, all these people, you know, having sex day and night and this and that, and so living completely free of all that. There we have the third. Okay, now we're going through the ones of speech. Okay, abandoning false speech, he dwells refraining from false speech. A truth seeker, one to be relied on, trustworthy, dependable, not a deceiver of the world. Okay. So I think that's kind of beautiful. It really reminds us that when we speak the truth, we become reliable and trustworthy. Yeah. And trust is such an important thing in our relationships. How do we become reliable and trustworthy? One big way is speaking the truth, you know, saying the truth as far as we know it. And so we become trustworthy, we become dependable, and we don't deceive anybody. Sometimes, you know, It was quite interesting for me, you know, in the youth program. Remember we had that one discussion group about lying? Remember that? And it was so interesting because to hear, you know, people's different views on lying and the different areas in which different people lied, and how even though, you know, we're taught from the time we were kids not to lie, and even though you know, many people had taken precepts before, still the mind, you know, likes to lie. It finds quote unquote good reasons to lie, to deceive. So it was quite an interesting discussion. It made me realize that it's not good to take things for granted, that even things we learned as children, we really need to have discussion groups about and explore. Yeah? You know, even the thing of like, well, the second one, you know, not stealing. We learned that as kids. But, you know, to really think about and talk about the various ways in which we take what has not been freely given and how we think that's important in the situation, necessary in the situation. So it's quite interesting. But they're really emphasizing, you know, that if you keep if your speech is pure in that way and telling the truth, then people see you as reliable and dependable and trustworthy. And that's a big thing for having good relationships. Okay, then abandoning malicious speech. He does not repeat here what he has heard there to the detriment of these, or repeat here what he has heard there to the detriment of those. Thus he is a reconciler of those at variance and an encourager of those of at one, I think meaning who are already unified, rejoicing in peace, loving it, delighting in it, one who speaks up for peace. Okay, so this is the one about creating disharmony with our speech. Okay, so not repeating there what you've heard here, and not repeating here what you've heard there for the detriment of the other party. In other words, not talking behind other people's back, which is one of our favorite pastimes. Okay, so instead being exactly the opposite, being a reconciler of those that are at variance, so people who aren't getting along, encouraging them to get along, and then also people who are already getting along, encouraging them to keep getting along. Okay, so this person rejoices in peace, loves it, delights in it, and speaks up for peace. Yeah, so really using our speech to create peace in the world. Yeah, instead of creating conflict and jealousy and rivalry and bickering and factions and everything else, really using our speech to reconcile others. Okay, then the next one, abandoning harsh speech, he refrains from it. He speaks whatever is blameless, pleasing to the ear, agreeable, reaching the heart, urbane, pleasing, and attractive to the multitude. Okay, so avoiding harsh speech. He refrains from it, okay? So, you know, losing your temper, yelling and screaming, ridiculing, teasing, making fun, pointing out people's faults, being spiteful, being derogatory, you know. We've done it enough. We know what it is. Okay? So instead, that person refrains that, and instead speaks whatever is blameless. Okay, so something that's not dumping negativity on somebody else. Something that's pleasing to the ear, that's agreeable. Okay, so pointing out others' good qualities, praising them, building, having a discussion where we build on other people's ideas instead of competing with them and trying to cut them off and put their ideas down. So speaking in a way that reaches the heart, that is urbane, pleasing, and attractive to the multitude. So what a practice, you know? I mean, really making this your life's practice to speak in this kind of way. Okay, and then the fourth one of speech, abandoning idle talk, he speaks at the right time, what is correct and to the point of dharma and discipline. He is a speaker whose words are to be treasured, seasonable, reasoned, well-defined, and connected with the goal. Okay, so this person abandons idle talk. Okay, so just talking blah, blah, blah about politics and sports and sales and all sorts of things you don't need to talk about, just to hear yourself talk, you know, talking things that are motivated by attachment, motivated by anger. Even Dharma can sometimes become idle talk. Yeah, because we're explaining the Dharma to somebody who doesn't really want to hear it, who isn't interested. Or we're talking about a seemingly Dharma topic, but we're singing our own praises and we're talking about our own stories and, you know, here's the story of my life, blah, 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 even though it's all involved with Dharma, but our motivation is basically to hear ourselves talk. Okay, so abandoning that, this person speaks at the right time. Timing is very important, you know. When is the right time to say something? When is somebody going to be open to hear what we say? And when are we just... You know how that is? Sometimes you hear somebody says something in a conversation. I don't know if this happens to you, but it happens to me. And inside there's this feeling, it kind of comes up from my belly of, I've got to say something right now. What that person said is wrong. I've got to cut it off right now. Otherwise, everybody in this entire group is going to believe that what that person said is a good idea. Okay? So this, like, this feeling of, like, I've got to correct them right now. Okay? Anybody else have that happen? Yeah? So then we jump in and, you know, we correct somebody and we do that, you know? So it isn't the right time. It's, you know, it's not that... You know, this feeling that, you know, the whole world's going to go down the tubes if we don't correct this wrong view. You know, lots of people say lots of things. It doesn't mean everybody who's listening is going to believe it. Of course, if, you know, people start turning towards that idea for a long time, you know, for a while, as the conversation progresses, you can offer a different view. But at that point, it might be with a calmer mind and a good motivation instead of, you know, gotta clamp that down, you know, like it's a cockroach. That view's a cockroach. I gotta smash it. You know? Okay. Okay. So this person who speaks at the right time, what is correct and what's to the point. Okay. So they say something that's accurate. You know what drives me crazy in conversations is when people say, I heard this from somebody else, but I'm not exactly sure if it's true. So they tell you some story about something that you really want a good answer to, but they're telling you what they're not even sure themselves is true. Okay? I don't know about you, but I really don't appreciate that. Because I feel it just creates confusion. Yeah? And so if you are fairly certain something is accurate, explain it. But if you really aren't, then maybe better not. You know, maybe better say, well, you know, let's think about it, or let's do some more research, or I heard this, but you know, yeah, don't make a big deal about it. Okay, so that person speaks what's correct and to the point, so they don't go, it's correct, and they don't, it's to the point. They don't go on and on and on and on. Some people repeat themselves endlessly. They go over the same thing and again. They say things the same way that I'm doing it right now, again and again, just to repeat yourself, to go on and say the same thing again and again. So not like that, okay? But you say what you have to say to the point and then give space for, you know, some other people to talk. Okay, so correct and to the point. They speak of dharma and discipline, ethical restraint. So they speak of something that's worthy, something that is uplifting, something that's beneficial. Okay? That doesn't mean that if there's a problem, they don't talk about it. You know, I mean, lots of times we interpret that, I've got to be a good Buddhist and there's a problem here, or there's something fishy going on here, or looks like this person is doing something dishonest, but, if I say anything, then, I'm being a bad Buddhist and I'm criticizing people behind their back and it's gossip and it's this and it's that. So then you keep your mouth closed, and meanwhile somebody goes on continuing to do something that's very harmful because everybody's afraid of saying everything, something. Okay? So it doesn't mean that. Yeah? When it says speaking of dharma and discipline, it doesn't mean that when there's a difficulty, you just ignore it and avoid it. Because, if there's a difficulty, it needs to be addressed and brought out in the open. It needs to be brought open out in the open at the right time and in the right way, so it can be discussed in a useful way. But if we just sweep things under the table all the time and pretend they aren't happening, then other people, it lets other people continue to do things that harm themselves and others. And similarly, if it's this something going on between us and another person, if we don't talk about it, then sometimes our mind just builds it up to be a really huge, huge thing. Whereas if we just bring it out in the open right away, then we realize there was a misunderstanding and we let it go. I remember one time, and I tell this story because it really affected me, when I was living in France and Lama came to visit, and he only would come like once a year, once every couple of years, and he would always check up how people were doing in the community, and he would want to know, what's this one doing, what's that one doing. He would usually wind up talking to most of the key people in the community who were his students. But then, he also wanted to hear from other people, how somebody was doing in their job or what was up. So I remember one time I had an appointment with Lama and we were talking, and he asked me how a certain person was doing. And I felt like there was something kind of weird going on with that person. But then I didn't want to say anything that, behind their back and talk negatively, because I wanted to be a good Buddhist. And especially to my teacher, I didn't want to gossip and say something bad about somebody else. So I kind of hemmed and hawed, and Lama picked up on what I was doing. And he said, "No, you've got to tell me, And I realized then, yes, Lama's motivation was to benefit that person. And so he needed information about how that person was doing and what was going on so that he would know a way to benefit them. Yeah? So I'm just trying to put idle talk in some correct perspective here, that there are times when we do have to talk about problems and people's, stuff that's going on with people. This person who abandoned idle talk, he's a speaker whose words are to be treasured. Isn't that nice to think, if you practice well, that your words are treasured? Yeah? Not that you're treasured, but that you manage to say something that's inspiring to another living being so that they treasure the words. Seasonable, reasoned. Okay, so it's not just like blah, blah, saying anything that makes absolutely no sense, but something that's well thought out, well-defined, and connected with the goal. So, we speak, it's something well-defined, we express it clearly, and it's connected with the goal of what we're trying to achieve by talking with this person. Okay? So it doesn't matter if you're talking about the Dharma and the goals of Nirvana, or if you're talking about how to do the patio, okay, or how to make the applesauce. The you know, our words are reasoned and well thought out and so on. And turkeys are coming. More people coming to listen to the teachings. Okay. Then he goes on here more about, you know what? I better stop now and have some time for questions, and then we'll do this other part tomorrow. Questions? Yeah.
What about, like, in a joking manner, like, doing impersonations of people? Like, with your friends, like, impersonating your mother or father because you know them? Please, like, say, like, I'm hanging out with my friend, and we're both sort of making fun of my dad, and, like, in an endearing or loving way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're asking about, you know, making fun of somebody who isn't present or is present.
Like, if I was just sort of like joking around about a relative or friend of mine.
Okay, so joking around about a relative or friend and they're not present.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that depends a good deal on your motivation, because some of our joking around, if we look, there's a very subtle wish to put somebody else down. Yeah. Other times it's just, you know, there's no wish to put somebody else down at all. It's just, you know, we're laughing together.
Sometimes it's almost like I'm praising the person by joking around. I mean, like I might, for instance, as an example, like be talking about some good quality of my father or something, and joking around, doing an impersonation of him with my friend. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
Sort of exaggerating it like in a sarcastic way.
Okay. But when we're exaggerating a quality in a sarcastic way, you know, with sarcasm, there's usually some wish to kind of undercut somebody. It's not just a playful kind of teasing. So I think, you know, if it's just a playful, humorous thing and, you know, there's nothing whatsoever in our mind, you know, that's bad, that's fine. But often with sarcasm, you know, I mean, I don't know if I can make it say always with sarcasm, but quite often with sarcasm, there's at least when I'm sarcastic, it's like, let's see if I can chip away here and cut something down. Okay. So I think it basically comes back to your motivation.
Yeah, I have a strong habit, like a long-standing habit of doing that. And I think that, it goes back to just like my friends from when I was younger and stuff. And it's kind of like an odd sense of humor that a lot of people don't get. You know?
Right.
But
yeah.
Some people do.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like it's just, you know, basically like what you said, you have to just be careful. Motivation.
Yeah.
I know I've done it a lot of times with like friends and relatives where I really didn't, like, even looking back, I don't really feel like I had like a negative motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was idle talk though. You know, mm-hmm. You don't really need to joke, you know. How useful is it to joke around like that, I guess?
Right. Right.
It's just sort of like,
Yeah. So I think, it's maybe just doing a little check about how useful it is, you know, what the motivation is. You know, sometimes I think if the person is there and we can get the person to laugh at themselves, in other words, they started it out and we amplify it, so we all wind up laughing at ourselves. So we're not just pointing, you know, making fun of somebody else and their qualities when they're not there, but we're kind of, they say something about themselves and we join in with that, and then we say something about ourselves and they join in at laughing about us, and so that we all become able to laugh at ourselves, you know. I think that can be quite helpful. But when the target is always somebody else,
then I think sometimes also like with my friends and so forth, turns out it gets to the point where we're joking around about the person so much that it's not even, you're not really talking about the person anymore. It's more like an archetype. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not even, I mean, it's not, almost not even really talking about the person. It just becomes a voice.
Yeah.
Or a character or something.
Yeah.
You know? So it's almost like cartoon type of thing.
Mm-hmm. But again, just to check on the motivation. Do you have some thoughts on that?
What you said sort of resonated. I had a habit of doing that, especially with this one friend. And then it was really good because he called me on it, because he perceived it, and it was really true. It's a subtle sort of passive-aggressive thing. Like, I'm too nice to really, like, yell at people, and I'm so funny. But the way I used to get him was to tease him, like, too hard, you know, in the kind of just too cutting of a way. But then, you know, and then in my own mind, I rationalized that I was just teasing him out of affection, but he really perceived it as aggression, which it really was, that I wasn't even conscious of. So I really appreciated him calling me on that eventually, and then I had to look at what was going on with that dynamic and look at my motivation. So I think you do have to be careful. And for me, I noticed when I started doing that, you know, it would be pretty unconscious, and then I have to look, why am I attacking them through this passive-aggressive way of, like, teasing them too hard?
Yeah.
You know, and what's going on, what's bugging me about our dynamic, and I should just deal with that in a really straightforward, honest way, rather than just doing these subtle, humorous digs that I can write off as being funny, because it's really not, and the person felt attacked.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And Lama used to do this thing sometimes when he would crack a joke, and he would say joking afterwards, you know. And even though everybody knew that he was joking, he would still say joking. And it made me realize, because I started, made me be aware more of how humor works, and how sometimes somebody is joking, but another person doesn't interpret it as joking. You know, like your friend didn't interpret it as a teasing. It was something brutal. And so sometimes, too, how we're joking, but we're not joking. Okay? So I watched Lama say that. And sometimes, you know, he would joke, and we would all be laughing, and he would say joking. And then sometimes he would go joking, maybe not joking. And then you looked and, okay, what is he really meaning by this? Okay.
That sounds like a good method, actually.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, like, looking back on it, I don't know how clear I've always been about that. You know? Probably usually not that clear.
Yeah, we often aren't. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I find that what happens with me the few times that I get going and the wit comes out is that I make people laugh, and then it becomes a detachment to reputation.
When
people laugh, well, then I can continue, and then before I know it, I'm just totally forgot that it was just this harmless little insight that I got because people respond, feed the ego, and before you know it, you're just cooking, you know?
Yeah.
Over people left and right.
Yeah.
And then you suddenly realize you're totally into just the fix of having everybody's attention on you. And being popular and being attached to your position.
Yeah. And especially these kind of cutting remarks, you know. One of the guys I write to in prison telling me that he had a real big problem with his mouth, as he put it, because he would just go and, like, say these real cutting things to other people. And he started to become more aware of it. And he discovered that when somebody else seems to be happy, he doesn't like it, you know? And he would just go up and say something cutting out of the clear blue. Yeah? Give you some feeling of power, give you some rush that, you know, to be able to...
The other thing, too, that I found that I'm very sensitive about is when I have people who are near to me and we've had some honest dialogues with each other where we just sort of show our little Achilles heels, and then we find out in a group of people that it then becomes common knowledge in a joke. Fill in the blank, and it was something that had been shared in confidence, but then it becomes part of the common knowledge as a funny little quirk or something like that you're not quite ready to, like, you're in a public space with some people you don't even know, and things like I find that I'm you know, and I look at that too, but I've had a sensitivity about that with very close friends who know me so well that sometimes they just come out there.
So there's two things there. From our side, when we're speaking about other people, not to make jokes of their sensitive points that they've confided in us because it might be very hurtful to them. But when we're that person and somebody else is making fun of us over a sensitive point that we've confided, then, you know, our job really is to learn to laugh at ourselves instead of clutching on to this self-image of I'm just this horrible person and I told that person my story in secret and confidence about this horrible quality I have that I'm so attached to it I'm never going to let go, and how dare they laugh at it. You know, I mean, because I get terribly attached to these things, you know? Yeah, I get, so I'm seeming to contradict you here now and then. But really, I mean, this is the situation I find myself in, because otherwise I just get, you know, my job is not to do that to anybody else, but if somebody else does that to me, I've got to learn to laugh at myself. Yeah? What am I so attached to my own stories and confidences about?